from the beginning of this series, one of the key problems that has been fairly obvious to you is that in discussing human ritual behaviour and people's reaction with the powers on the other side, there are tremendous difficulties with language. One key word after another has to be defined. And when we get to this stage, we come to yet another of these troublesome words. This particular word is magic. Magic is a word that has considerable emotive power. It's a highly poetic word in English. And also, it's a word which you're probably well aware recurs again and again in the anthropological literature, though at the same time you're probably also aware that anthropologists have often been rather wary about using it. It's a word that has a certain slippery quality. And for this reason, Malinowski coined the term magico-religious to describe sort of all those kinds of points at which people interact with the other side without necessarily saying quite what magic is or where it ends. Now, unlike the words that I've defined up to now in the sequence, words like myth or ritual, at this point it does seem to me that we've come to a word which has some enormous difficulties attaching to it, to such an extent that as far as I can see, there is no distinctive area of human behaviour and no distinctive area of human knowledge to which the word magic can be applied. Or to put it another way, magic is a word we don't need to use. You'll notice that I haven't actually used the word magic in any of the lectures up to now. And what I'm going to do in this particular lecture is not, therefore, to expand upon what magic is, very much as in the previous three lectures I expanded on what myths are. Instead, I'm going to lay out to you what the difficulties are, I mean, both how magic has come to be used and why, at the same time, there is no need whatever to use it. To begin with, let's look at what magic means in modern English. Let's look at magic as a word in the language. There's not any slightest doubt that it's there. And furthermore, of course, I'm not suggesting for a moment that we can get rid of it. I'm not saying we must try and force people to abandon this word. That would be impractical. As far as we know, no governments, no priesthoods, and no academics, not even l'Académie Française, have ever actually been able to control the course of language. Language has its own life. It develops whether people like it or not. In a way, it's a bit like myths. As I was saying last time, myths are a bit like viruses. They go about their business using people, but not really under human control. And languages are like that too. They develop in quite regular sorts of ways, but in ways which are apparently undirected by people. In the same way, when we look at myths in the vernacular, or when we look at magic in the vernacular, what we have to do is to look at the way these words are used and can be used rather than trying to direct people's use of them. But if we are going to look at words as technical terms, then it seems to me, to reiterate, that magic, unlike myths, is a word that we do not need to use. It has no value. The first meaning of magic, and this meaning is incidentally quite a clear one, and indeed in some ways a useful one, is to mean illusionism. Magic is conjurer's tricks. Magic is party pieces, party performances. Magic is what Paul Daniels does. Magic is what David Copperfield does. It is a quite specific facet of showbiz, which in the final analysis does not claim to have anything to do with the relations between the human and the superhuman. It is real. It is a genuine part of human activity, but it need not concern us here. It's not something we have to spend time on in a series of this kind. Far more tricky are all the other meanings of magic, the use of magic in the vernacular, but in ways which are not anything like so clearly defined or so clearly circumscribed as the activity of the showbiz illusionists. What about magic in these various other senses? Well, let me give you an example. When I was a graduate student, a Canadian woman who was one of my contemporaries told me an account of how, in the recent past, she had been trying to attract a particular man whom she used to meet on various occasions. But as is the case, as you all know so well, when you try to attract somebody like this with stubborn regularity, they never show the slightest interest in you at all, and this was exactly what she had discovered. Quite unconnected with this, she happened to try a new kind of hair dye that had come her way, and she tried it, and she wasn't particularly struck by what had happened, but very soon afterwards, before the effect of the dye had worn off, she went to a party at which this particular man was present, and he immediately came over to talk to her. And she said to herself, this is her own account, this isn't hair dye, this is magic. Now, that's a very good example of magic on the loose, not illusionism, but the magic of everyday life. In this context, I suppose it means something like wonder-working or miracle-working. And, of course, the existence of miracles and the working of wonders is a very important part of the borderland where human beings encounter the superhuman. But it is not something which requires the term magic, because, after all, we do have terms like miracle, and we have expressions like wonder-working, which cover the ground quite well without using magic at all. So that, in this sense, we're not any the closer to a technical term for magic. But, of course, if we remember this example, it shows us the sorts of meanings that magic has. Magic is associated with the wonderful when it occurs. It's also associated with the deliberate working of wonders, of people setting out to bring about the miraculous, to work wonders with deliberate purpose. When we do what I suppose at this stage we have to do, and look at where this word comes from, its history, how did it get into English, we discover that magic has its roots back in the classical world. In other words, in a sense, it's very similar to the word mythos that we were looking at an earlier stage in the series recently. The word was used by the classical and the Hellenistic Greeks, but it was recognisably different for them from the word mythos, because mythos was one of their own words, whereas magia, or however it was pronounced, was a word which basically they had borrowed from neighbours to the east, the Iranian peoples, the Medes, and the Persians. Among these peoples, the derivation of the word was associated with the priests, who were the devotees of the prophet Zarathustra, and these priests were people who performed what were, within the Iranian world, the regular rituals of most of the population. For the Greeks, however, these priests and these rituals and all the associations of Zarathustra were essentially foreign. They were practices which were poorly known and which were somewhat mysterious. They had no native place in the Greek world, and they were associated with what in modern English we would call the Oriental. They were associated with those people who lived out to the east. The Greeks' relations with the Iranian peoples were somewhat ambiguous. On the one hand, they were quite impressed by them. The Iranians, after all, had established by far the greatest empire in human experience at the time when it was set up in the 6th century BC. But at the same time, they were people who'd caused the Greeks a great deal of trouble, and the Greeks had fought some very strenuous wars against them. Magia, therefore, or Magia, was something to do with these ambiguous peoples, peoples who lived out there. And from this point forward, the word in Greek, and when it was borrowed by the classical Italians into Italian, was associated with the mysterious, but also with the ill-defined. I ought to point out, of course, that within the context of Iranian Zoroastrian practice, what was being done was perfectly straightforward, respectable, and orthodox. It didn't have those connotations of the mysterious and the slightly sinister that it picked up as it travelled west into Greek and into Italian. Now, that is the basis of the use of magic in, say, modern English, or indeed the similar forms in modern French. And what has happened is that because of the prevalence of classical learning in Italian, in Latin, and in Greek, the word has entered into the languages of certainly the whole of Western Christendom, the languages of Western Europe, in one form or another. It has become part of the familiar, certainly scholarly knowledge of people far beyond the Eastern Mediterranean and far beyond in time the end of the classical world. In this sense, it is somewhat like muthos, somewhat like muthoi. It's a word which has a long classical history, and it has come to roost in the post-classical languages of the Western world. But at the same time, as I've pointed out, whereas muthos was thoroughly acclimatized, magia, or magia, or however it was pronounced, is something which has a very different quality and is associated from the beginning with the foreign, the alien, the alternative, and possibly with the sinister. The meanings which have come through the classical world have never basically changed. There is a sort of common ground which goes through. The problem is, first of all, a problem of anthropology, and then I shall go on to talk about what magic means in the history of the vernacular for the peoples of Western Europe in the post-classical world. I'll start with the anthropologists, because when we look at them, we realise just how difficult it is to come to terms with the word classically. That is, when we insist on dealing with this word as something which can be dealt with as precise language within the vocabulary of anthropology, we immediately discover that all anthropologists have really encountered some difficulties of some kind. And it's possible, I think, for me to demonstrate quite early that really the word has never come to rest with any kind of precise meaning at all. Let's begin with the classical age of anthropology, the period between, well, the figures are rough, but let's say circa 1850 and circa 1920, the period in which Marx and Engels were writing, the period in which Morgan was writing in the United States. It's the period of Durkheim, and it's the period of Lévi-Brulle also in France, and in the British Isles, Tyler and Fraser were writing, and Spencer was also writing too, in this period. I don't need to exhaust the authors of this period, but it does give you some sense of what we're talking about. The classical period is a period of great theoretical activity, a huge amount of very ambitious theorising about the ways in which people behave, the use of huge bodies of information, though in fact these authors of the classical period are relying for their information on missionaries and on travellers and on people normally other than themselves. Their images of the people of tropical countries may be very accurately portrayed to them. I mean, when Fraser, for example, was relying upon the writings of Bishop Calloway among the Zulu, or the writings of acting Bishop Robert Codrington among the peoples of the southwestern Pacific Islands in Melanesia, a term which was just coming into use, he was using information which was extremely well found in the first place, although what Fraser did with it was another matter. Fraser was building enormous theories on the basis of evidence which was not, by its origin, necessarily geared towards that kind of theorising at all. Now, without entering into what happened in that classical period of theoretical development, it is possible for me simply to tell you what Fraser made of the word magic, because Fraser was one of the authors who attempted to use the term technically, to give it a precise meaning. And a lot of authors who have written since Fraser's time, since that sort of late 19th, early 20th century period, have in fact used Fraser's definition of magic without acknowledgement, believing in some cases apparently that it was a standard definition. There is no standard definition of what magic means, and there's never likely to be. But in order to understand the problem of magic in anthropology, it's necessary, certainly, that I tell you what Fraser meant by it. Now, Fraser's broad theory of human cognition, and Fraser is preeminently a cognitive writer, his interests are in what people know and in how they know it. He was not particularly interested, for example, in processes of government or of leadership, processes of social discipline or community coherence. He was preeminently interested in knowledge as such, and he came to believe that the history of human beings can be divided broadly into three phases. When I say the history, I should say, of course, strictly the prehistory and history of human beings, that is, the whole span of time that human beings have been on Earth. Fraser is not necessarily very forthcoming in the detail of quite when these phases were in different parts of the world, but as three broad phases, I can define them fairly quickly. Cognitively, people began by believing in magic. In the second phase, they came to believe in religion, and these terms need defining. I'll define them in a moment in Fraser's terms. And in the third phase, they came to believe in science. And people like university professors of Fraser's time were among the finest exponents, in Fraser's view, of science, the most advanced phase of human knowledge up to his time. Let's go through these terms and define them as Fraser perceived them. Magic is the key to our understanding today, but I will have to tell you something about religion and science, because otherwise you won't understand what Fraser was getting at. Magic was a conviction among the most primitive, that is, in the strict sense, the earliest of human beings, that if they understood the way in which the universe around them and they themselves were working, they could work out processes of control. Magic was a combination of knowledge and practice which enabled you, first of all, to understand the workings of reality and then to turn it to your own ends. It was therefore a highly technical process, and it was a process which involved a very strong confidence in the ability of human beings to bend reality to their own purposes, to their own ends. Now, the sort of thing that was involved in this was that if you found a particular sort of plant which had flowers which were the colour of blood, you assumed that this might be helpful in conditions which involved bleeding or which were affected by injuries in which blood was shed. Possibly, of course, they could be used for menstrual disorders, but certainly there was an association. As a matter of fact, long after the quote-unquote primitive world in which magic is alleged to have been discovered by the first human beings, if you look at Western Europe in the feudal period, you will find that the monks involved in herbal remedies and in certain aspects of the prescription of medicines for curing people put forward a very elaborate and developed theory of precisely this kind, long before Fraser got round to talking about it in these terms in his big book, The Golden Bough. And you will see, of course, that this preoccupation with the symbolism of colours and of particular organisms which can be used in medicine is something which comes right into our own times and is by no means exclusively associated with the ancient past. I ought to say, by the way, that Fraser himself believed that magic, religion, and science as modes of cognition had survived into his own time, but he regarded the magical kind of beliefs as most primitive. That is, they were the ones that started earlier. I was saying something about monks in the 14th century and thereabouts with their views on the character of colours and usages and similarities. And I ought to say, of course, that they were convinced that God in his providence had provided appropriate plants for healing and had given us clues in their appearance as to what they should be used for. Lesser celandine, for example, beginning to flower at this time of year, lesser celandine, called pilewort in Middle English, was believed to be very suitable for the treatment of piles, precisely because part of the plant looked like piles, and so on. There's nothing particularly primitive about this, I ought to say. It is very, very advanced, very refined image medicine of a kind associated with immediately pre-modern Europe. But Fraser's point was that the very earliest people used imagery of this kind, that, for example, if you built a large fire and then damped it down to produce black smoke, you would be producing imagery which looked like clouds, and if you wanted rain, this was a good procedure to use. I should point out that all Fraser's evidence was being derived either from modern peoples or it was being derived from classical literature and from other sources which were fairly recent, considering that human beings have probably been around in some form or another for about 4 million years. And therefore, of course, his basic evidence was none of it derived from the primeval period when people are alleged to have been going through this highly magical phase. Now, I won't agonise on about Fraser's theorising. Perhaps it would be more helpful if I contrasted his view of magic with his view of religion. According to Fraser, in the cognitive history of our primeval ancestors, they discovered after a bit that their confidence in magic was misplaced. They found that their understanding of the universe was not too good, and that the techniques they were using to bring them food and health and prosperity weren't actually working too well. They therefore became disillusioned with their own powers of control and became convinced that the universe, far from being under their control, was under the control of superhuman powers far greater than themselves. Wiser, more knowledgeable, more powerful, more in control, able to bring them that the food and the health and the long life and the prosperity and, if necessary, the victory over their enemies, which the attempts to control the universe for themselves had failed to produce. They therefore turned in supplication to the superhuman powers and asked them to help them. At this point, they were moving from the magical phase of human experience to the religious phase of human experience within Fraser's terms of reference. Remember, I am telling you here what Fraser said. I'm not saying that you should necessarily accept this. They moved from the phase of magic to the phase of religion. In the fullness of time, however, Fraser felt, people had begun to wonder whether religion worked either. In other words, their supplication of the superhuman powers was not necessarily bringing them all the goodies that they were hoping it would. They still got defeated, they still suffered from epidemics, they still suffered from droughts and from famines. The world was not a bed of roses, far from it, it was more like a bed of thorns. And in practice, therefore, they became increasingly disenchanted with this wonderland which they at one stage believed they had discovered, and they turned back to a more we are in control kind of approach, though of course immeasurably superior to the old-fashioned magical way of controlling things. Oh, indeed, yes, now they had discovered, in Fraser's terms, science. They moved back to the broadly magical approach to things, but with the conviction that this time they'd really sussed it out, this time they'd really got their hands on the levers, this time they were really going to get it right, and science would deliver the goodies. Fraser, as a matter of fact, was not necessarily convinced that this third phase was going to get people into any better state of affairs than either of the previous ones. And Fraser himself was apparently a rather mournful character and tended to be pessimistic about human beings' ability ever to get it right or to get their hands on the levers properly anyway. But the point is, we needn't worry too much about that. Some of you may be interested in where Fraser got this scheme from. One possibility, which I don't want to push too hard, is that there is an autobiographical element in it, that Fraser himself went through phases of this kind in his own childhood, and possibly indeed other people do as well. But of course that's not quite a basis for the sorts of generalising that Fraser himself engages in. It's a bold theory, I don't believe a word of it, but that's not something which we need to worry too much about here and now. What I'd like to do is to emphasise the fact that this is a particular definition of magic. Magic is the ability to gain a knowledge of the world about us, and then, by the appropriate use of incantations and spells of the right substances, you can gain control and bring about actions which are desirable from your point of view. I ought to point out there are people in London at the moment who basically believe all this and are certainly doing it. In other words, Fraser is not without, as it were, unwitting disciples in the generations after his death. Now, by way of contrasting Fraser's view of magic with somebody else's, I will use somebody else who has also been extremely influential in the definition of magic and has had clearly a huge effect on subsequent literature, as you can check for yourselves by doing a bit of reading. The second example I want to emphasise is Emile Durkheim, a French author of Jewish origin, part of a mainstream of development in French anthropology, which also includes Mauss and Levi-Strauss, and an author of a very different kind from Fraser. His emphasis elsewhere and his views on magic are so diverse from those of Fraser that the two definitions are in fact totally incompatible. That if you believe in a Fraser kind of magic, then you cannot at the same time believe in a Durkheim kind of magic. Let me say something about Durkheim's views. Clearly, both of these authors, if you're interested in the development of classical theory, are worth looking at very closely. That's not my purpose today. I simply want to consider how they viewed magic. Just as Fraser was the author of an enormous classical work, The Golden Bough, originally in 12 volumes, even the abridged version is pretty daunting for the readers of this period, because of course people nowadays in Western Europe are nothing like such assiduous readers as they used to be, and the prospect of actually having to read your way through the abridged version, not the 12 volumes, but the one volume edition published in 1912, is of course for modern students, certainly for most of them, totally overwhelming. I can remember the very real consumer resistance which I encountered way back in the sort of late 60s when I suggested to some students in Cambridge that they should read the abridged edition over the vacation. Clearly they were not very keen. I suspect that students in Cambridge now are even less keen on having to do that sort of amount of heavy reading. The point is that if you look at Fraser's work, you can contrast it with another single work of Durkheim's, because Durkheim published a number of significant theoretical books, but none of them weightier than Les Formes élémentaires de la vie religieuse, a book in which he laid out a very complex interpretation of how human beings came to look at reality in the way that they do, and a book which is in some ways a parallel, a French parallel to The Golden Bough, and in some ways also a rebuttal, an answer to The Golden Bough, which is also broadly cognitive, but one of the great differences between Durkheim and Fraser is that Durkheim, unlike Fraser, was very interested in human beings as social animals. He saw the human individual not as a kind of lonely philosopher working out the meaning of things, which Fraser rather implies in The Golden Bough, but he saw human beings always as people embedded deeply in communities. He had a highly communal sense of being human. This may, of course, be rooted back in his own Jewish past. He came from a family of rabbis, and he may well have got his sense of the communal from his Jewish background. But he also had a sense, which one would expect, of course, from a French writer, of the agonized individual, isolated, alienated, anomique, suffering from the torment of being an experiencing human individual, and in many ways disturbed by the process of being embedded in the social, embedded in the community. Durkheim was very aware of the possibility or probability that if you are an experiencing individual, at some time you will find yourself at variance with the people around you who are your kinsmen, your neighbours, your friends, your allies, but also, in a sense, your enemies. I mean, there is a sense, of course, where one can feel in Durkheim's writing a build-up towards the writing, say, of Sartre, during the 20th century. The French agonistic tradition of the experiencing self is very strong. Now, let's look at what Durkheim wishes to tell us in the hundreds of pages of Les Formes élémentaires. Well, I won't try and tell you what the book is all about, because this is basically a lecture about magic, but it's impossible to talk about magic, magie, in Durkheim's terms, just as it's impossible to talk about magic in Fraser's terms, unless we see how he fits it into his scheme of human development. Like Fraser, basically Durkheim was an evolutionist. He believed in a development of human cognition, but a very different one from that of Fraser, and one, of course, which at every stage assumed that human beings were highly social animals. And his view of the development of what he called religion was that people's sense of the presence of the superhuman powers, and in this respect he was a bit like Fraser, that people's sense of that was developed because of their experience of themselves, their experience of the pressure which people put upon each other as moral beings. Human beings are constantly pressurizing each other into various kinds of actions. We all have some sense, even though none of us, perhaps, have ever grown up in a truly coherent community of the kind that Durkheim was talking about. We've not grown up with hunters and gatherers. We've not grown up with small groups of pastoralists. We are, most of us people, who have suffered in the way in which we grow up from the process which Durkheim himself described as anomie. We are, to some extent, isolates. To some extent, we're dysfunctional. To some extent, we're uprooted from the normal human condition of living in a community. This is, incidentally, something where Durkheim's observations are very sound and have to be taken extremely seriously. He runs into more trouble when he starts trying to relate the differences between the rootless and the deeply rooted to the development of religion. He sees religion, the sense of the alternative, the sacred, that which is beyond us in our mundane selves, as being part of our sense of moral pressure upon us. By contrast with this, he sees magie as the opposite of religion. It is that process by which human beings withdraw from their community quite deliberately to engage in solitary practices which are not directed towards the public good in the way that religion is. Although Durkheim never precisely equates magie with sorcellerie, with witchcraft, nevertheless, he writes about magie in terms which are distinctly derogatory. You get the feeling with Durkheim that he does not approve of magie. It is not, as with Fraser, a primordial mode of human cognition. It is something which is at the best self-centered and tipping over into the distinctly perverted and the criminal. This is something which people do, and if anything, they didn't alter, because, of course, Durkheim's preoccupation with the social is so intense that he is very concerned that people should not go off and perform their own special rituals, because if anything, they're going to end up doing the sorts of things that witches do. They're going to sort of make their neighbours' wives abort. They're going to start making their neighbours' cows barren. They're going to wither the way the plants. They're going to wither away the plants which are growing in their neighbours' fields. They're going to wither the barley and the wheat and the maize and so on. In other words, in Fraser's highly moral, highly social world, whether it's derived from a Jewish model or not, in his sort of world, to go off on your own and to engage in private rites is highly suspect. Now, as with Fraser, so with Durkheim, his definition of magic has been borrowed by large numbers of people who have not always acknowledged the source. Indeed, many of them, I suspect, don't even know the source. These two definitions of magic have both become very, very deeply entrenched. not only in French and in English language literature, but also in other European literatures. Anthropologists writing in German or in Russian have been affected by these definitions. Anthropologists writing in Chinese and in Japanese, languages from well outside Europe, have also certainly been affected by the definitions of Fraser and of Durkheim, sometimes not even realizing that these are in fact particular definitions from a particular source. Now, it's quite clear to you, I'm sure, by now, that if there are these two contrasting definitions of magic in circulation, then we're in trouble from day one. And when we realize that these are not the only usages which are abroad, I mean, for example, if you look at Malinowski, whom I've mentioned earlier in this lecture, we find that when he's discussing the Trobriand Islanders, and as you all know, he discussed the Trobriand Islanders in hundreds and hundreds of pages of published print. I don't think he quite reached Firth's record in writing about the Tikopia, where you end up with more pages in print than there are Tikopia. But nevertheless, he was moving in that direction, and Raymond Firth, his pupil, travelled further along the same road. But Raymond Firth, on the whole, was not too preoccupied with what magic was, though, of course, like all of us, he had to some extent wrestle with the problems of magic. When we turn back to Malinowski, we find that his notion of magic is very much coloured by notions which he received from Durkheim. He saw magic as something which people go off and do on their own, but not necessarily as quite as sinister as the rites that Durkheim seems to have had in mind. Conspicuously, when you're a Trobriand Islander in the Malinowski period, you go off into your yam gardens and you talk privately to your ancestors, asking them to make the yams grow. This is an activity which in English we would call praying. And praying was an activity which Durkheim certainly saw as perfectly respectable and as part of public religion. The processes in which these Trobriand Islanders were involved were processes which were not necessarily antisocial at all. In fact, if everybody, of course, went off and talked to their ancestors to make the yams grow, hopefully the entire village would end up with a bumper yam harvest, which would basically be a rather good thing, and not in any sense a bad thing or related to, shall we say, witchcraft. These are, in fact, perfectly healthy, sociable activities. Another example, briefly, Evans Pritchard, living with the Zande in the 1920s. The Zande have figured already in this series. This is a rather different aspect of the Zande from the one I've emphasised earlier. Evans Pritchard's now classic book on the Zande, Witchcraft, Oracles and Magic Among the Zande, includes, even in the title, the word magic, which is the term we're discussing today. And for Evans Pritchard, magic seems to be essentially not necessarily linked to the impersonal processes that Fraser was emphasizing, nor to the highly personal processes that Malinowski was emphasizing when you go off into your yam gardens and talk to your ancestors, indeed engaging in something like private prayer. For him, magic, for instance, hunting magic, which was very important among the Zande, and indeed similar rites are very important among most African peoples, was something which was perhaps less well defined than the yam magic of the Trobriand Islanders. Large numbers of minor rites which were carried out by individuals were treated as magic by Evans Pritchard. To some extent, he's using the term really as any minor functional ritual, any ritual that an individual might perform to improve his prosperity or his prospects of success. At this point, even by drawing attention to four writers alone in the history of modern anthropology, and without going beyond the English and French language streams of anthropology, you can see that the field is a wasteland, that we're dealing here with definitions of magic which cover just about every kind of ritual which human beings perform. We're dealing with a word that has little more meaning than transactions between the human and the superhuman, the subject of this course, but not a very useful definition for a technical term. Indeed, at the end of the day, definitions of magic are not much different from definitions of religion, and I've warned you earlier of the dangers of using the word religion. You can probably see by now why I have no intention of ever using the word magic at all. It's not a word that of which I feel any need. Although, of course, I'm not doubting that the sorts of practices that formed the basis for Fraser's, Durkheim's, Malinowski's and Evans-Pritchard's discussion are certainly there. I mean, these practices are real in human experience, and the motives that lie behind them are, although less tangible, are also thoroughly real. I'm not saying that the evidence from Calloway or from Codrington, from Malinowski or from Evans-Pritchard is a load of nonsense. I'm quite sure it's not. And in my own experience, I have come across other people in other places doing similar things and apparently driven by similar motives. But this is all part of the broad field of ritual and belief. It's all part of the world of human encounter with the superhuman, which I'm not, of course, playing down, because that's precisely what this series is about. What I'm saying is, it is the word magic which is not particularly helpful to us. Magic is a word we just don't particularly need. And yet, of course, you will all say, there it is in English, there it is, almost the same, in French. Why is it that in the experience of the peoples of Europe, we did not in fact lose this word long ago, as we lost so much of the heritage of the ancient world? After all, we're not all now living as if we were in classical Athens. We're not all now living as if we were in classical Rome. Surely we could have dropped the word magic along with lots of others long ago. Well, yes, indeed, we could, and it's often quite difficult to explain how languages develop. I've made a few comments about language earlier in this lecture, and as I've said already, languages have their own development. Languages, a lot of the time, you often feel have a will of their own. They have a life which is quite independent of that of the people who speak them, and they surge relentlessly ahead. And it is therefore very interesting that the word religion and the word magic, both of them coming from the classical world, like the word myth, these words have survived vigorously to the present time. And that is something which anyone who's interested in language and in the way in which language fits into historical process has very good reason to ask questions about. I don't deny that. Magic is still with us. It's still a vigorous word in the language. Even if we carefully screen out the specialist meaning of illusionism, something which I tried to do at the beginning of this lecture, we can't therefore pretend that magic is not a powerful word in English or in French. It clearly is a very powerful word. And perhaps some comment has to be made about this. Why are we still going on about magic even after the 20th century has come to an end? Well, yes. Remember what I said a short while ago about the Greeks and about the classical Italians, what I said about Athens and Rome and the other city-states of the classical world. For them, magia, or magia, was something which has its roots in the Oriental. It had its roots in the mysterious and the East. For many Italians of the classical period, Egyptians were seen as people with very strange practices and knowledge, the source of all sorts of, well, in modern English, using a Latin word, we would say occult practices. If you look at the history of the Roman Empire, you'll see that there was a generalised belief that Eastern sort of people, the kind of people in English we'd now call wogs, were much more tied up with these sort of strange, spooky practices than people who lived further west, people who lived in the Spanish Peninsula or in the Italian Peninsula, Gauls and British, and these rather more wholesome people were not like those woggish sort of people who lived in the East, who had some very strange practices, and some of them really quite sinister, you know. Now, these kinds of attitudes, the attitudes towards the wogs, the attitudes towards the Oriental, have shown remarkable persistence through to the modern period. When you look at modern British newspapers, no names, ranting on about the Ayatollahs in Iran, ranting on about Saddam Hussein, even much further west, ranting on about North African strongmen like Gaddafi. There are times, for anyone who's familiar with the Roman Empire and with the earlier classical world, where there is a sense of tremendous familiarity here. You do really sort of get that sense that not much has changed in the last 2,000 years, and that this sort of deep-seated suspicion of these very sinister, woggish people really has come through into our own times. Again, I won't try and explain this, but it is relevant to the whole issue of magic, because when Christian theologians of, shall we say, as late as the 14th or 15th centuries, Joan of Arc's time, were looking at the meaning of magic, they were to some extent still affected by a classical literature to which they had access. Although they were perhaps less conscious of the Iranians than the classical Greeks would have been, they were certainly conscious that magic referred to practices which were not very desirable, even though they were not necessarily very well defined. I'm not guaranteeing that 14th and 15th century West European theologians had a much clearer definition of magic than, say, late 19th or 20th century anthropologists. But nevertheless, it was a word that was in their vocabulary, and by and large, they didn't approve of it. Now, insofar as magic has a place in the history of Christendom, in the history of Europe, both Western and Eastern Christendom, the church which built up around Rome, the Eastern Orthodox churches which built up around Constantinople and Jerusalem and Alexandria and so on, insofar as magic has a place in this story, that place is a somewhat ill-defined borderland position between the truly Orthodox, that which was definitely Christian, and which could be defined by reference to the Bible, by reference to the writings of the fathers, by reference to the deliberations of the councils, and which had been very carefully worked out by centuries of assiduous Christian theologizing, on the one hand, and on the other hand, those practices which definitely came from the past, which were, in the strict sense, superstitio, they were those things which were left over from an earlier age, and which those people who became Christian had to abandon. For example, if we look at the history of the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes in this part of the British Isles, we realise that what the peoples of this area, who were themselves, many of them, colonists who brought their practices across the North Sea from the North European plain, but what these people had to do when they encountered the Christian missionaries, Augustine and the others, Augustine and Wilfrid, and these other worthies who play such a part in the history of this area, what they had to do was to abandon, of course, the worship of Thor, the worship of Woden, the worship of Frey, the worship of all these other gods who they were accustomed to worshipping when the Christian missionaries arrived. They had to abandon sacrifices and any other rituals directed towards these gods. And it was fairly clear what the pagan world of superstitio was made up of. And it was almost as well defined as the world of Christian doctrine and of Christian ritual. But in between those things that definitely had to be given up and those things which were definitely Christian, there was an ill-defined borderland. When Bishop Gregory, writing from Rome to Augustine to encourage him and instruct him in his mission, talked about the practices of these people, I mean, Gregory seems to have referred to all of them as Angli, but they were, as I've said already, certainly Jutes, Saxons and Angles, possibly a few other people thrown in. But in the colonisation of the British Isles, various different groups had arrived across the North Sea, though they were very similar to each other in language and also apparently in ritual practice. What Gregory said about these Angli was that if they had practices which were harmless, practices which were not injurious to the Christian faith, practices which certainly did not seem to endanger their immortal soul, there was no reason why the missionaries should officiously get rid of these practices. And this, of course, became deeply entrenched in Christian missionary and practice, not only in Europe, but further afield as the Christians in the modern period spread out from Europe into the wider world, which they had now discovered. Just because people have a practice, and they had it centuries before the Christian missionaries arrived, this is not an argument for getting rid of it. For example, their agricultural and livestock practices may well be very benign indeed and very well adapted to the life they live as farmers in the place where you find them. It would be extremely unwise to change their farming practices just because they have become Christians. And of course, Gregory and other very sane bishops of his time realised that you do have to be very careful that the missionary enterprise is not one which involves simply mindless destruction of other people's cultures for the hell of it, or in the name of the Christian gospel. Now, given that very important proviso, which plays a big part in the Christian mission history of not only the British Isles, but other parts of Europe, it is not surprising, of course, that large areas of European culture were not directly touched in the first instance by the arrival of the missionaries. Any of you who want to understand what people like Augustine and the others were involved in, Patrick in Ireland, Boniface in the country of the various Germanic peoples, should go and live in modern Africa at the present time, because, I mean, for me, certainly as an individual, all this literature from early European history came alive when I found myself living on a missionary frontier in modern tropical Africa, where all these issues are totally relevant, and where you can actually see pioneer missionaries who are living the life of Patrick and Augustine and the others at the present time. And you realise, of course, that there is this grey zone, that there are those practices which people must definitely give up, and there are the practices which are definitely Christian and which have been recently introduced by the missionaries, but there's a whole host of other things which are very ill-defined indeed. And this ill-defined borderland could be harmless and benign, the kind of thing that Gregory was talking about when he wrote to Augustine. But at the same time, some of these practices may not be benign. And of course, harking back to earlier lectures, you can understand that under conditions of heightened sensitivity to witchcraft and fear that there are more witches about than usual, certain practices which might have been considered harmless 20 years earlier are likely, of course, in certain conditions to be considered far from harmless at the present time. So anyone who practices anything within this grey zone could be accused of witchcraft. A famous example in modern English history, of course, has been the charming of warts. Now, the charming of warts may appear to be pretty harmless by Gregory's definition when you are a Christian missionary arriving from afar and finding the various practices of these local people in the British Isles, whom it is your duty to bring, if possible, into the Christian church. But the charming of warts at the same time is not a specifically Christian practice. It could, of course, with a bit of effort, be Christianized. The Christian missionaries, very practically, brought into the Christian fold the ritual practices associated with farming of the Angles and the Saxons and their neighbours, because clearly farming was something of very great importance, and it should be something which the clergy themselves should pray for and take an interest in. But this still left other things over. Now, what seems to have happened in the history of the last 1500 to 2000 years is that magic has become associated with that borderland between the fully orthodox and the thoroughly disgraceful. And of course, as time goes on, the thoroughly disgraceful boils down not to worshipping Thor and Wodan, but to practicing witchcraft. You know, that to a large extent, the evil practices are all of them various forms of witchcraft. But then there is, as I say, the grey zone. And you get the same sort of thing in Muslim societies. If you go to the Near East or to North Africa, you will find that, again, there is this this zone. The word magic may not crop up in local Arabic forms, though, of course, it's known to Arabic scholars. But it's nevertheless clear that there is a grey zone. If you go to the Western Sahara, if you go to Morocco, if you go to Tripolitania, you will find that there are these areas which are not fully orthodox and yet are not witchcraft. So that how one regards them perhaps is very often a question of how fundamentalist and puristic is your attitude towards Islam. Some Muslims would say, of course, basically, if it is not specifically enjoined upon Muslims, then Muslims should not do it. Whereas others would say, well, if it's not actually forbidden, why shouldn't we do it? And therefore, of course, within the context of these missionary movements, these evangelistic faiths, of course, there is always the likelihood of that grey zone developing, and it is in this grey zone that repeatedly, in modern European history, the term magic has been used. What I'd like to do next, at the end of this series, is to look at the broad system in which all of these practices, all of these prejudices, all of these images, all of these symbols are embedded.